You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 22nd, 2022. My name is Emma Bigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Stephen Thrasher, author of The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll, When Inequality and Disease Collide. And later in the show, Dominique Remy, here to talk about Project Canary, a documentary about maternal mortality rates in the United States. Meanwhile, Trump's legal woes, part one. A three-judge appeals court panel has sided with the DOJ and against Trump and Judge Eileen Cannon, despite the fact that two of the three on that panel are Trump appointees. The probe involving his stealing of classified documents can continue now. Trump's legal woes, part two. New York AG Tish James has announced a lawsuit against Trump's real estate empire, including Trump and three of his kids, after an over three-year investigation for financial fraud. Jeannie Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and election-denying right-wing activist, has agreed to be interviewed by the Jan 6 committee. That will be juicy. The House has passed the electoral reform bill spearheaded by Liz Cheney and Democrats. The bill would make it harder for members of Congress to bog down the certification process with objections. Only nine Republicans voted yes. The Senate agreed to the first international climate treaty in three decades yesterday, working to phase out hydrofluorocarbons, one of the worst pollutants contributing to climate change. The AP has found that the Eagle Bumps guy, Ohio congressional candidate J.R. Majewski, seems to have fudged some things about his military service. But he seemed like such a straight shooter. The Intercept is reporting that DeSantis chartered the planes used to fly dozens of migrants for a political stunt from a big Republican donor in Florida. That means money from the state, supposed to go to COVID relief, went directly back to that Republican donor. And lastly, in Russia, more than 1,300 people have been detained after anti-war protests sparked in the country due to Putin's decision to call up 300,000 reservist forces for the war in Ukraine. All this and more on today's program. A reminder that the WNBA star Brittany Griner is still detained in Russia. I mean, the idea that this is still going on, it's hard to say what the nature of the negotiations with the United States, the Biden administration, and Tony Blinken entail, but it's just unconscionable.
And it's a very interesting case study in sort of the power of elite, I guess well-placed, like basketball players, right? Yeah. Like basketball players being politically active. They were told at the start of this to keep it quiet and let the sort of State Department and all those folks deal with it. And I suspect that was because they don't want the price to grow for Brittany Griner that Russia can exact or something like that. But they were told to just trust us, and the players kept it quiet and trusted them for a long time, and we're still here.
And I mean, it also underlies, in my opinion, a certain hypocrisy in the United States, which is that Biden was the one presidential candidate on the Democratic side to essentially say that he wasn't for marijuana decriminalization on a federal level, and the reason that Griner's been detained in Russia is because of empty or almost empty cannabis cartridges. So it's difficult to say authoritarian state when we incarcerate people for the same reason.
Well, I mean, the policy, I'm fairly sure this is true. America pioneered the drug war and forced a lot of countries to sign on with it, including about marijuana. And I certainly think that Russia's being opportunistic for like a political reasons here in this arrest. At the same time, Joe Biden is deciding not to deschedule cannabis from the Fed, like you said, decriminalize it federally. And that's just a choice he's making that is going to tie up thousands and thousands of people in the same sort of if not tens of thousands in the same sort of BS.
With that said, let's dive into Trump's legal setbacks, because two of them, just two whammies in the news today. I mentioned a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has essentially said that the DOJ can resume its inspection of the classified records seized at Mar-a-Lago in the investigation into Trump here, which they, in their decision, essentially mocked Judge Eileen Cannon for a lack of knowledge about like basic structures of the federal government and a judicially unsound decision. It was a bit of a shock because of that panel, as I mentioned, two out of three of those judges were appointed by Trump. But it's, I think, a testament to how flimsy his argument here is, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Or maybe we'll get to it now, actually, how flimsy his argument is about his just blanket declassification because he decided to. Here he is on...
Not only did I declassify them, but I also did a special second thing that says I can't get in trouble for anything to do with these documents, too, which the president could do.
No takesy backsies. Don't you get
Sorry.
It? Sorry.
I pardoned myself for these documents.
He was looking into pardoning oneself. We remember that from that time. And I do think that...
I Googled that on a private browser tab. I don't know how anybody found out about that.
It does, in my opinion, shed light on his pardoning of Scooter Libby, because that was years before. But Trump also probably wanted, apparently some of these documents contained information about U.S. agents overseas. And just like, you know, goes to show what the mindset of a right winger is with that kind of information. They say that they want to protect, you know, the country, and yet Trump wants to use it for whatever purposes, bragging rights,
deals, closing some deals.
He just leverage and negotiations.
Did you hear the thing where I can't remember, some former governor's son was drunk at Trump Tower, and I should get this story. Maybe we'll talk about this in the fun half. But Trump brought it up in negotiation. I think it was in like New Jersey, and he's like, "Wouldn't it suck if the press found out about your son being drunk at my hotel?"
Yeah. Would be very bad. Would be very bad, because you know his kids are so straight edge, right? But here he is sitting down with Sean Hannity talking about the former probe, and then we'll get into a little bit what happened with Tish James in the New York Attorney General's office.
So let me ask you this question, because I think this is the next logical question, because the president of the United States, you, unlike say Hillary Clinton in her case,
right,
a president has the power to declassify.
Correct.
Okay. You had said on Truth Social a number of times you did declassify.
I did declassify, yes.
Okay. Is there a process? What was your process to declassify?
There doesn't have to be a process, as I understand it. You know, there's
yes, there does.
Say different things, but as I understand it, there doesn't have to be. If you're the president of the United States, you can declassify just by saying it's declassified, even by thinking about it. Because you're
I'm sorry, I'm paused. I am just reminded of, and I don't normally cite The Office because sometimes it gets a little bit overdone, but I am reminded of Michael Scott standing in the middle of the office and screaming, "I declare bankruptcy," and thinking that that's all he needed to do. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. But I mean, Trump, it's hard to know if he actually buys his own BS. He's just using this now to get out of this legal tangle that he's
also
in the public eye.
I have to point out, like, declassification, that should be like those things should be published and put into like a public clearinghouse website so everyone can see the declassified info. It doesn't mean you get to like hoard them at Mar-a-Lago privately.
Right. Yeah. Any declassification process means like we need these for historical records because of, you know, importance.
Yeah.
You
can go mix them in with your Time magazines.
Yeah. I mean, and Trump understands this because he, by the way, and I'm sure you remember this, Matt, said he was going to release some of those JFK documents and chose not to declassify them.
Got cucked.
So he understands what the process of classifying and declassifying is. But continue. I couldn't help myself.
Different things, but as I understand, there doesn't have to be. If you're the president of the United States, you can declassify just by saying it's declassified, even by thinking about it, because you're sending
thinking?
It to Mar-a-Lago or to wherever you're sending it. And there doesn't have to be a process. There can be a process, but there doesn't have to be.
It's internal to my brain.
You make that decision. So when you send it, it's declassified. I declassified everything. Now, I declassify things, and we were having a lot of problems with NARA. You know, NARA is a radical left group of people running that thing. And when you send documents over there, I would say there's a very good chance that a lot of those documents will never be seen again. There's also a lot of speculation because of what they did, the severity of the FBI coming and raiding Mar-a-Lago. Were they looking for the Hillary Clinton emails that were deleted, but they are around someplace? Were they looking for the spying on Trump?
You had it.
No. They may be saying they may have thought that it was in there.
Okay.
And a lot of people said the only thing that would give the kind of severity that they showed by actually coming in and raiding with many, many people.
So severe.
The Hillary Clinton deal, the Russia stuff, there are a number of things. The spying on Trump's campaign. So they spied on my campaign.
All right. Well. He's lying. Even Hannity can't really buy it.
He's like, well, because he asks his follow-up is like, wait, you're not saying you were in possession of Hillary Clinton's emails.
And yeah.
He's like, no, but they might have been looking for them. Like,
why weren't they so severe with her? They're only severe with me. It's so unfair.
I declassified everything.
Everything. Just by thinking it.
I have this thing that might sort of illustrate why Trump is collecting secrets from the government just like haphazardly. This is from Ilya Maritz. A wild anecdote here from former New Jersey Governor Christy Whitman, who essentially says Trump tried to get her to oppose an infrastructure project with what amounted to compromise on her son. This is from ProPublica. A few years before the tunnel vote, Whitman's son Taylor, who was in high school at the time, had gotten falling down drunk at a private dance at Trump Plaza Hotel off Central Park in New York City and had to be taken to the hospital. This is something that high school students stupidly do, and Whitman said to me she was happy for Taylor to be sick to teach him a lesson. But in the call, Trump suddenly brought the episode up. He said it would be too bad if the press found out about her son's drunken antics. He made the threat during the deliberations over the tunnel, Whitman said, and it blindsided her because the high school dance was private and Taylor's behavior had been a family concern. She had no idea how Trump found out about it, she said, but the episode made it clear that the people collected and delivered sensitive information to Trump about what happened in his property. She did not buckle to Trump and never made good on his threat. And that is why you should not underestimate Trump or, frankly, anybody who owns a hotel with elite clientele and their familiarity with, say, intelligence operations that they are perhaps funding. You spy on your guests. Like, that's what these, especially a hotelier like Trump, who's so politically active and, like, does all these deals, he's spying on his guests.
He loves collecting blackmail on people to use
Absolutely.
In negotiations. This is how this guy operates. So, I mean, I think that is the most likely reason that he was collecting these kinds of things.
Why would he collect stuff on Macron? Like, it's obvious.
Yeah, it's not for him to just, like, touch himself at night to it, but like it's for him to, and partly I think it's like titillating that
exactly
he likes
yeah.
to, you know, but
I mean what services his ego and his sort of goals are basically the same thing,
right? They're synonymous. And just an aside too, like the declassification element, while it's funny to talk about, it's largely irrelevant to, or it's not irrelevant, but it adds an extra layer of potential criminality for Trump. But the underlying issue is that he stole documents in general that are supposed to go to the National Archives. So it doesn't matter if I thought through the power of my brain, I moved objects with my mind, I made these things declassified.
Yeah.
The issue is that you stole the documents in the first place. The documents could be whatever they are. That's the problem. And that you hid it from the FBI as they were kindly asking you over and over again, please return these. And then he returned light files and kept others so that he could get away with holding on to the material that he actually wanted to hold on to.
And it's funny, this sort of like nod toward like, people might not have ever seen these documents if he's some sort of Edward Snowden figure. Like, you kept them at Mar-a-Lago under like Wendy's wrappers.
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember finding this stuff out about Macron. You haven't published any of this stuff. It'd be different and frankly interesting if Trump took a whole bunch of documents and put them on Truth Social.
Yeah.
But that's not what he did.
I'm a whistleblower. That's what I'm doing.
The first president, ex-president whistleblower. Eat your heart out, Jimmy Carter.
And to like, for this to happen on the same day as this Tish James lawsuit, I just want to touch on that briefly before we head to talk to Stephen. Like, the lawsuit is essentially, it's targeting the Trump organization, including his three oldest kids. It's hundreds of pages and identifies, I believe, around 200 acts of fraud, including him overvaluing properties so he could get better deals from banks and insurance companies and inflate his own wealth. One of them was that he showed that he got an appraisal for $200 million, then valued it at $500 million and said that, like, oh, this is the appraisal. No, that's fraud. That's just your identification of how you want it to be valued. And so he was like trying to inflate it for better relationships with banks, even though he had a bad reputation still in the United States because of multiple bankruptcies. He was trying to inflate both his personal wealth and the valuation of his properties to places like Deutsche Bank so that he'd get more favorable loans. And at the same time, he was understating the value to pay less in taxes. And like, I've seen defenses of this saying, well, everybody does this, right? Yeah, that's the problem. And so, yeah, maybe
one way to stop that would be to prosecute a high ranking example.
And the problem is people are going to say this is, you know, politicized. And I'm sure, yeah, Tish James is seeking this because it's Trump and she's the New York Attorney General. That's fine. That doesn't take away from just like the blanket obvious fraud that seems to have happened here. And so she's seeking some serious penalties, like $250 million in surrendered funds and a ban on commercial real estate loans for Trump in New York. So we'll see where that goes. But these two twin legal battles directly implicating Trump, and that's not, you know, excluding the January 6th committee. That's excluding what's happening in Georgia, the probe down there. A lot of things to watch here because it's heating up, and I think it's doing so in anticipation of him potentially announcing a run for president, which he's been teasing over the past few months. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Stephen Thrasher. We are back, and we are joined now by Stephen Thrasher, journalist, professor of journalism at Northwestern, and author of The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll, When Inequality and Disease Collide. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, I mean, your book's title, it borrows, The Viral Underclass, it borrows from a phrase, and you write this, used by AIDS activist Sean Strub. And you know, I know much of your work has focused on HIV criminalization and stigma, and that is a very prominent through line throughout your book. Why was that frame of reference useful for you in studying pandemics, sickness in general, the COVID-19 pandemic as well, and then like as a conduit into your work, the viral underclass here?
Well, I had finished doing my research on the story about Michael Johnson, this young man who had been sentenced to 30 years in prison for HIV transmission exposure, and eventually we got his sentence overturned. And I'd used as the basis of my research for my doctoral dissertation. I was thinking about how to turn it into a book when COVID-19 happened. And I was looking with some of the people I work with back at my dissertation again and saw that the final chapter was called The Viral Underclass. And I was kind of ending that that story by thinking about the ways that a viral underclass is produced with HIV criminalization, how Michael was an example of it, how there are other ways to think about it. And it was actually my book editor who said, you know, why don't you step back and think about, this was March of 2020, how that might be a framework to think about COVID-19. And so that was kind of the starting point that I used to think about the pandemic, to understand why it is a viral underclass that is produced between different pandemics. And I could see that with COVID-19 when I just started turning to the particularities of that virus, which is an extremely different virus from HIV in almost every imaginable way. They behave differently, they act differently, they just have very, very different characteristics. But the first people dying of it in those first months were in the sort of maps and the same zones of people I've written about affected by HIV and AIDS. Geographically, politically, demographically, there were lots of similarities. And so I wanted to understand, why is it that the same kinds of human beings will end up in the pathways and affected by these extremely different viruses? And once I sort of had that analytic, it gave me a better way to understand how these health disparities come about with HIV or AIDS, hepatitis, monkeypox, coronavirus for many of the pandemics that we go through.
I mean, and I don't say this lightly, but, and I believe you say this in your book, but this is such a useful lens that you can, I think, put it up there with Naomi Klein's shock doctrine as a way to view these broad societal kind of upheavals and look at a lens particularly through that. Was that a part of your inspiration?
It was. I mean, very much so. And I was so incredibly touched when I eventually asked Naomi to blurb my book, and she did. But her analysis has been so helpful for me for many years in my own understanding of the world as a leftist and an academic and a scholar. And I wanted to think about, you know, this viral underclass, which the term, as you said, was originally coined by Sean Strube, and I'd heard activists use it different ways. But I really wanted to use it as an analytic to understand the horrible things that we were seeing in those first couple of months and then years of the COVID pandemic. And then unfortunately, this last summer with the monkeypox outbreak, I saw almost all the same things playing out. Again, fortunately, the mortality with that virus is much, much, much lower. But the ways that it played out, the missteps, you know, how it came to be, why queer people of color ended up so affected by it, so many of the things I could see them through that same analytic, as you can see with different pandemics across time.
So you mentioned the story of Michael Johnson, which is another major theme in your book. Tell his story a little bit, because, you know, as you write, viruses kind of both show cracks and widen cracks in society. And the cracks were visible before the pandemic began, but there needs to be more sunlight on them. And one of these stories that's so emblematic of that is Michael Johnson. Talk about his story and how he ended up facing trial for transmitting HIV.
Certainly. So Michael Johnson was a young man, as he's older now. I've been writing about him for almost a decade. But he was in his young 20s when he was a college student at a university called Lindenwood University in Missouri. And he was arrested and accused of transmitting HIV to two people and exposing three. Eventually, charges were, well, four men against him. And for listeners or viewers who are not familiar with it, you can be prosecuted for transmitting a wide variety of viruses throughout the world and pathogens, but the one I've studied the most is HIV. And in most states in the United States and about 70 countries around the world, you can be prosecuted for exposing someone to the virus or transmitting it, the virus to somebody else, even under circumstances where it can't happen at all. There are people in jails who are accused of spitting with HIV, and it's one of these alleged crimes that gets the sentencing enhancement. So kind of at the most nefarious end of it, if you are arrested by a police officer and they bash your head into the ground or their police car and you start bleeding and you have not told them you have HIV before you start bleeding, they can accuse you of trying to murder the police officer. That's kind of at the most nefarious end of it. The way it happens more often is people will say, I injected drugs with this person or I had sex with this person. They didn't tell me their status. And the onus is on the person to prove that they did tell it. And these are not good from a public health standpoint because we want people to feel safe and able to disclose their status and know that they'll be taken care of. And so when these high profile cases like Michael's happen, it makes it much more likely that people won't get tested because you can't be prosecuted if you can't be tested. So Michael was a young college student and wrestler. He was extremely talented as a wrestler. Like too many athletes, he had gone through college not really being able to read or write very well. And he was very popular on his campus with athletics, with students, until it came out that he had HIV. And he was accused of transmitting it to two men and exposing it to several others. And when I first heard about the case, I didn't know much about this topic or about him. The news about it had just been prosecutors' press releases as if he was some kind of global menace to people who might get HIV. But when I met him, it was a very, very different story. He was an extremely interesting and kind young man. He has always maintained that he told his partners his status. And he really became known to me was a scapegoat for all this anxiety that people have around HIV and AIDS. One thing that happened over the many years of reporting about him was that the CDC came out with a statistic that one in every two Black gay men in the United States were projected to become infected with HIV in their lifetime. And that's a good way to understand. I think that we can't think of viruses as individual people negotiating individual risk. If one out of every two people are going to become affected by something, something is deeply wrong in the society with a lack of collective protection to stop mitigation of these kinds of viruses. But Michael was sort of a perfect scapegoat of saying, we're just going to put all of our anxiety onto him, especially since one of his screen names that he used in Grindr and social media was Tiger Mandingo. And that word Mandingo just like brings up all this anxiety from U.S. racial history. So he eventually got sentenced to 30 years in prison. And he was facing, not coming out until he was almost 60 years old. Fortunately, supporters of his used my reporting and used other information to mount an appeal, and his conviction was eventually overturned. And he got out after about 6 years in prison, but he still lost most of his 20s. He was in prison from 22 till he was almost 29 years old. And so that was kind of the way that I started to think about and understand that, you know, people who are Black, who are queer, who have learning disabilities, who are athletes who get used for their bodies to generate money and then discarded by the university when they seemingly become a problem. These are all the things that create what a viral underclass is. And my kind of aha moment in that was that his story happened in a county just west of St. Louis, outside of St. Louis. But then when I got sent back there to report for The Guardian about the killing of Michael Brown, another young Black man named Michael, I worked with the same HIV people I'd worked with before and asked them what to look for when I arrived in Ferguson. And they told me they had been in the Canfield Green apartment complex recently. There had been new infections, and Ferguson had this higher rate of HIV and AIDS. And so I started seeing that the same dynamics, Black poverty, concentrations of police violence could be a map to where the HIV virus was. And that when you looked at places that had these social factors, HIV was more likely to be there. And when you also understood where HIV was in the country, you were much more likely to also see economic violence, racial violence, police violence happening to the same people.
So when the viral underclass gets blamed, and then when you have a scapegoat like Michael, it makes it a lot easier for the people who want to maintain a status quo of a, say, for-profit healthcare system, one that leaves people to face their healthcare burdens on an individual level. It makes it a lot easier to maintain that system when an individual can get blamed, and then not just an individual, a large group of people, where there already is this kind of muscle memory in society of Black bodies in particular being like impure, tainted vessels. And I mean, I'm reminded of like the crack baby theme and how mothers would get blamed for if a baby was experiencing complications post-birth because of those things. Like, that trope is to use this again, a through line, and it creates, like, a deflection of blame downward as opposed to upward.
Yeah, so, you know, for me, kind of the move out of the move in the book, out of my dissertation, which my dissertation research and the prior reporting was really very much concentrated on race interacting with sexuality. And in the book, I'm thinking about a viral underclass happening across 12 different vectors. And race is probably the most important. It's the first one, and it interacts with many of them that I write throughout the book. But there are multiple ways it can happen. And it does, as you're talking about, intersect with these sort of racial tropes and this muscle memory that we have about the racialization of disease, you know, Dorothy Roberts' work and the ways that we imagine a racialization and criminalization happening, you know, the same way in the United States. So for example, like you said, with the quote unquote crack baby theme, that's something that we think of in a racialized way. We think in a racialized way about drug addiction as well. And so it's interesting, I think, that we can look back historically and see moments where drug addiction and news media and politics really focused entirely around race, or almost entirely around race, particularly with crack. And then when you see meth in the news or opioid addiction now, the race around it, the presentation of it, is a little bit different. It's happening a great deal, and I write about this in the book, in Appalachia and in the U.S. South and in rural communities that are very white. And so there'll be a bit of a perception around it. But for the people for whom this is affecting, they are still interwoven with the racial history of it and the ways that addiction and racial prejudice are intertwined with one another in such a way that when we do see these outbreaks of HIV and hepatitis happening with the opioid crisis, you know, throughout Appalachia, it is treated with the same kind of stigma. And those people are also part of a viral underclass. And one of the things that I'm hoping that readers might get out of it, or policymakers might get out of it, is that who is in the viral underclass can change. And a lot of Americans think that they're only a few steps away from being a billionaire, but they're really much, much closer to falling into this viral underclass at any time. And another sort of aha moment for me was in one chapter I write about this dynamic happening in Greece. A lot of the beginning of the book is about the U.S. history and our history with race, and its historical legacy with the transatlantic slave trade. But if you look at England under Margaret Thatcher, if you look at England now under, you know, the Tory government, I write in the book extensively about the country of Greece experiencing austerity after their economic crash and how the EU imposed austerity on them. You see the same ways that austerity will bring a viral underclass to people who are raced as white, but with all of the prejudice, all of the disparity, all of the stigma that has historically come from racism. And I think that that's a call for a kind of solidarity that can happen from working class people of all races and all nations around the world to defy the need to even create a viral underclass among people.
I mean, and you write about this too, how this is essentially a lot of this muscle memory too. It's not, doesn't just go back to like the 80s with the example that I use, or the 70s, but I mean, it's rooted in colonialism and race essentialism from that, which is like there was disease that spread during that time period through travel from different continents, and Black bodies also bore the brunt of that as well.
Yeah, so when we look at, you know, the past couple of millennia of human history, the slave ship is one of the biggest vectors of disease in modern human history, or human history of the last couple of millennia. And one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is really think about the vectors that move viruses as structures and as spaces, not as individuals, which contemporary news media so much will do. But the movement of enslaved people from Africa to the Americas to unearth raw goods to then send them to Europe to be made into manufactured goods and created into capital, which then were used to buy more humans and to create this triangle that was happening around the Atlantic. That process was one of the biggest vectors we've ever seen. The ship itself, people, only 20% of people would survive. I'm sorry, about 20% of the people would perish on the ship itself. And then, you know, unknown number would die of pathogens in Jamaica, Brazil, what became the United States after they arrived. And so that process itself was probably, one of the most potent ways of moving pathogens. But historically, when we look across all kinds of colonialism, it is one of the engines of how pathogens move. When we were moving, and the neo form of it as well, when we were looking at where does HIV come from, you can really trace it to European colonists moving into the Congo and pushing what were called African porters deeper and deeper into the jungle, where eventually they're cutting bush meat for meat and trying to survive. And it's probably in the process of butchering animals in that process that HIV moved into human beings. And it happens, you know, quite similarly now as climate change moves more living beings onto a smaller part of the globe. Human beings are coming into contact with animals more and more often, and more zoonotic jumps are going to happen. What I find curious, and I don't deal with this in the book because I'm not quite sure what to make of it yet, and I saw it happen again with monkeypox, is that historically, we've seen viruses lodge themselves more often in the global south or in colonized countries than they were happening in the global north or the colonizing countries. But with the past few outbreaks we've seen, we've actually seen a lot more happening in the colonizers' countries. COVID has been horrible in the UK. It's been the worst anywhere in the world, in the United States. Something similar happened with monkeypox. We have polio coming back in the United States as well. And there's something about the ways that we, as the countries that historically have been colonizing and, you know, are quote unquote advanced industrial in terms of industrialization, are actually facilitating a great movement of pathogens inside our countries. But those viruses and those pathogens are still settling into the viral underclass within our borders.
Yeah, well, it's almost like kind of the dark and twisted consequence of globalization, which is like built on the back of like a colonial skeleton, right? So, I mean, that kind of it's unfortunate, but in the end, it's just like chickens coming home to roost to a degree. I mean, but of course, in the United, then the people, the viral underclass within those countries bear the brunt. And you mentioned monkeypox a few times, so I wanted to talk a bit about it because I was disturbed to see a lot of the language being used that was contributing to stigmatization of LGBTQ or gay men in particular in this country, that it's like there's whole swaths of this country who decided to forget about how stigmatized the gay community was during the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And I still feel like we don't reckon with it enough. And there was just callous throwing around a very similar language and stigmatizing talk that was used during that period when discussing monkeypox. And thankfully, it's not as deadly as other viruses, as you say. But what was your, perspective on seeing some of history, or at least historical language, repeat itself within that context?
Actually, I have a very, very different perspective on it. I didn't see many problems with language. I saw problems with the structures that created what was happening and not having enough resources go to it, but actually co-authored a piece in the Daily Northwestern, where I'm a professor today. And I wrote a piece in Scientific American. I wrote a piece in The Guardian about this as well, that I thought it was really important to name exactly what was happening and to try to deal with it as specifically as possible. When I first started, and I'm not, by background, I'm not an orthopox virus expert. I was not before this summer. So this sort of family of viruses, I wasn't as familiar with. But when I first started reading that 95 to 98% of the cases were happening among men who had sex with men, it seemed pretty clear to me that the mode of transmission must be sexual in some way. That's the only thing that we have in common. And yet the language often was sort of saying it could be anyone, it could be any kind of close contact, which didn't make sense. And still, you know, 6 months later, it's not moving significantly outside of this community. About 2% of the cases have been amongst women and children, and the rest have been among men. And indeed, one thing I think that's an important lesson from viruses is to have a sense of humility and to understand that they change and to keep studying them to see what they're doing. And there was a significant mutation. Monkeypox had been studied for 7 decades, but about 5 years ago, something happened to it in a way that seemed to change how it was moving. And so the symptoms around this version of it were not this outbreak of large lesions on hands and faces, back and feet from before, from close contact, but happening on the genitals and inside the anus, mostly of gay men. And so something different was happening. And I thought that it was really important to name that, to understand that, to put the vaccination efforts towards that. And I think a lot of well-meaning people did not want to even say that that was happening because they were afraid of stigma. But something also, something else happens that I thought was equally dangerous, which there was a vacuum of information and people were scared to be next to gay people, or scared, you know, might be scared to room with them or be in classes with them on a college campus. So I thought it was really important to name, like, this is how we see it's moving. It's happening. It seems to be moving through particular actions. I think there needs to be more research about them. And one of the reasons, just to give you an example of why I think it's good to focus on actions, is that if this is moving through unprotected anal intercourse, that could be something that's also a mode how it's moving into women. And so we need to understand exactly what that is, so that, you know, women who engage in that activity, men, people of transgender people, people of all gender identities, understand the action that could be what is causing it. And I've been, I was very frustrated with the Biden administration at the beginning of this because they had a purchase order on 300,000 vaccines. They took a cheap wait and see approach. And a number of us had been calling before Pride about the need to get ahead of this and vaccinate. And then too often, I think the U.S. will say, if something bad didn't happen, it was a waste of money. They don't do this, you know, you notice with terrorism or whatnot, they'll spend endless money to say, we're going to stave off a terrorist attack. But when we're all saying, like, Pride Month is, you know, in April and May, Pride Month is coming up. Like, let's make Pride Month vax-a-thon around this thing everywhere in the country. And they did not take us up on that. And so, like, the organizations and the people were sort of ready to do it. We just didn't have the vaccines. And the federal government finally got on it in July and August, and now we're going to need, you know, 10 million when we could have maybe snuffed it out much sooner. I was surprisingly happy with a lot of the press coverage I saw, but there was not enough of it early on. And it's a challenge, and it's like, it's a very, very difficult thing to, you know, to talk openly sort of about what's happening when there's still so much shame about gay sex and trans life. And when we have these horrible bills passing around the country, making it illegal for trans youth to get care or trans adults to get care, and making it illegal to teach young people how to protect their bodies. So I think that we have to be very careful about the language we're using, but we can't shy away from what's actually happening. And the problem, which is not an easy one to solve, is that we still live in a very homophobic and transphobic society. And undoing that, you know, is going to take time and work. Diseases are going to come and go, and we're going to have to deal with them in this environment. But we really have to undo the underlying transphobia and homophobia. And that, unfortunately, feels like it's very much going in the wrong direction in the United States, certainly in, many of these red Republican states, but also from the point of the federal government, which is not being proactive enough, even though it's controlled by Democrats.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess I have, like, instances of Marjorie Taylor Greene saying these are groomers spreading it to kids. Like, that's a little more prominent in my mind.
I understand, and I think it's well intentioned, but they're going to say that anyway.
Yeah.
And I felt like if we, you know, in that moment when there was a big push from a lot of public health people, and I wouldn't say public health people, from comms people and organizations that are not public health, to sort of say, oh, it could happen through any close contact, that actually opens the door to say, like, you know, don't let your kids around gay men because they might get monkeypox. And there were, you know, which I find, as a scholar, I find this stuff interesting. There have been a few, it's like 200 in the world, pediatric cases. They're very small. And those cases have mostly been extremely young infants who may have actually been nursing or, you know, becoming positive with that virus. And they've all been fine. There have been no deaths. But they may have gotten through nursing. And then they've been, you know, adolescents or teens. And those teens, you know, they also might be sexually active. And if it's moving through sex, like, we need to let teens know how to protect themselves, especially right now when there's, like, the move in the country to not talk about things. And you're right, Marjorie Taylor Greene is awful and is going to do those things. but she's going to do them anyway. So like, we should still give the most accurate information and just say, you know what, if this is moving through gay sex, like there's nothing to be ashamed about with gay sex. And I'm going to, as a scholar and a journalist, like just try to find out how queer people can have the safest sex that they can without making them feel ashamed about the unfortunate coincidence that we are the ones being in the brunt. Actually, I wouldn't say it's a coincidence. It's part of my book, because we can't deny ourselves and our community the information we need to be sexually healthy. And too often we're not even given that information in the first place.
I want to pivot now just to COVID in particular, because in chapter 3 of your book, you talk about the pandemic responses between South Korea, right?
Yes.
Versus the United States, and just like how these different countries place value on, like, immediately in the U.S. it was, how can we get back to work and how can we get essential workers, aka the people who are in the viral underclass, working class folk who are going to bear the brunt of the pandemic before we had vaccines, how can we get them back to work immediately? And then you see what's happening in South Korea, and it's just like an entirely different set of values.
Yeah, right. And that book I write about, it's the only kind of textual analysis that I do in the book, which was fun for me to do. But I'm writing about the movie Parasite, because that was a movie that really helped me understand these dynamics and also gave me an in to write about public health things that happened very differently in the Republic of Korea. And I think that we can learn a lot from other countries that don't, and I'm using this phrase in air quotes, quote unquote, look like us. I was at a panel the other day, or reading the other day, and you know, somebody sort of angrily in the audience in the Q&A was saying that, you know, why can't we learn from Canada and the UK, these countries that look like us, about what to do better? And I challenged them and said, what do you mean look like us? there are countries in Africa and Asia that look like us. And largely because my thinking has been trying to look back at research from Nigeria that gave us really great warning about monkeypox that was ignored, that would have helped us a great deal with what we're dealing with 5 years later. And of course, several countries in Asia have been giving us lead time on a number of things, not just in the past couple of years with COVID itself from Western China, but from the ways these countries, several countries dealt with the first outbreak of a different SARS, SARS-1, that happened in 2003, and lots of practices that came from that we could learn from kind of at a technical public health level. But with when I'm writing about South Korea as well in the book, I'm thinking about the relationship that populations have with their public health sectors and with their government. And they're very different. The U.S., we are generally distrustful of the government and certainly of public health interactions. Something else I found really interesting while researching the book, that a predictor of how countries would do with COVID was not how big the country was or small it was or how rich or poor it was. It was what percent of the money that they did spend went to preventative care versus emergency care. And so that spanned very rich countries and poor countries. There are some extremely poor countries in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia where the country itself is very poor. They don't spend that much money on public health, but they've been investing for decades in public health campaigns around Ebola and West Nile virus and malaria and things like that. And so when people have a relationship with a public health infrastructure and they may actually know the person who does these campaigns and they've been keeping them safe from Ebola for, you know, years or decades, and then they say, hey, you know, we've heard about this new thing that you need to protect yourself, they're quite likely to take that rather than the United States, where we spend like 90-95% of our interactions with the healthcare system in the emergency room, and people have literally no relationship with any public health until like the moment they expect to either die or be slapped with a $500,000 medical bill. It's very, very difficult to get buy-in. And so Korea is an example of a country where they actually don't have legal mandates the same way that we do here, but they've had really good buy-in from the public by continuously telling people what's happening, very simply saying, this is what we know right now. And also saying like, we may know something different next week. And then when they go back the next week, they say, here's what we know now. And so they've been able to, keep people using masks and doing all kinds of things to keep each other safe in just a very, very different way than we do in the United States. But they're still touched by capitalism and the market. They do have, though, in Korea, a universal healthcare system, which we don't in the United States. And that's also a really big factor in countries, is whether or not people have an easy infrastructure to get the medication and treatments they need, and knowing that they're not going to be economically bombed if they take advantage of medical care.
And I mean, I also find it fascinating that the emphasis in the U.S. here is so often on like the supply chain issues, the economic problems as a result of COVID. And then when lockdowns are discussed in the media here about like what's going on internationally, it's authoritarian as opposed to the simple data, the scientific medical data on deaths and infections and hospitalizations as a metric for beating COVID. And I think all of these, the intersections of how we not just view like our frontline communities and, but our, how we interact with our healthcare system, as you say, is, you can draw a direct line to that.
Yeah. It's, in the US, we get a lot of media about how draconian China is and how authoritarian it is. And of course, China's had some very strict lockdowns, but those lockdowns have been pretty targeted. I mean, in Beijing and Shanghai, and of course, in Wuhan, where the first outbreak happened. And, you look across the past few years, 95% of the population has been moving relatively, freely without issues, compared to us being in this constant, semi-state of terror and death. And even within that, not feeling extremely free to, quote unquote, go back to the before times, which we shouldn't. We've learned new things. Something I've been thinking a lot about the last week or so because of a conversation thread I've been a part of on Twitter, was a public health colleague asking why it was that the film industry in the United States seemed to be the only one that still had really good COVID protections. And if I don't know if you're familiar with it all, if any of your viewers are, but I have a lot of friends who work in the film business, and they still really mean business. It's extremely test oriented. Everybody's being tested every day, certainly while shooting and several times a week leading into shooting projects. There's extreme monitoring, there's isolation. And it's because I think there's an acknowledgement in that business that they cannot swap out their labor once they start shooting a project. And that to me highlights the ways that US industry thinks that jobs are essential, but the workers are not. The job needs to be done. If the worker gets sick and dies, then they just replace them with another one. Then they complain they can't find any workers, but as if they didn't have a role in stopping the workers from getting sick in the first place. In the film business, they see crew people as expendable as well, but even they have to acknowledge the reality that those crew people are interacting as biological beings around the talent. And they cannot afford not only for, Tom Cruise or whatever Tom Hanks movie stars to get sick. Anyone, once they're on camera, they can't just swap out the actor. And so they've instituted this way of protecting all of their labor. So it's not altruistic that they're doing it still to generate capital, but it's really revealing to me that because of the particularities of their business, they're doing something that all business should be doing. All businesses should not want their workers to die, and they shouldn't just be thinking they can swap them in and out. And it's also probably not generating more money for them to continuously be looking at labor in other industries. But so much of U.S. business seems to have their head in the sand right now. I was on a flight the other day, and they were like saying, and the captain who I'd seen was not wearing a mask before he went into the cockpit, was saying, oh, we're going to be delayed because of staffing issues in the air, the traffic control tower. Well, like, why do we have so many staffing issues right now? This is the reason why. And I am quite worried, having seen how poorly businesses have done, how many governments are trying to move these decisions back to their businesses. New York City, I just saw the mayor, Eric Adams, said he wants COVID decisions just to be made by employers, that they will know best what's best. And like anything else in terms of worker safety, I don't think it's good to let employers just decide what safety level should be.
What do you say to the folks who that we were hearing a lot about? We should have just done herd immunity. We should have done what Sweden did. But that hasn't aged particularly well.
No, Sweden, I mean, Sweden has gone through several different rounds of things. They also had an extremely, ghoulish policy around their elderly that's even worse than the United States, I would say. And herd immunity was never going to work as a concept in general. But we also specifically know right now, this is not a virus that you get once and then have lifelong immunity. You know, you can get sick multiple times from it. So herd immunity, or the idea that enough of the population is going to be vaccinated and sick in any time to protect itself, like that's going to last for a few months at most. And having people get sick with this thing that's had so many bad effects, as pretty bad mortality, but also has unknown long-term consequences, not only with long COVID, but just unknown sort of what's going to happen later, brings into relief the way that the U.S. is mostly given up on pathogen mitigation as part of our pandemic response. And with anything, influenza, chickenpox, monkeypox, any sort of disease that you're dealing with, part of an important thing to do is to keep people from getting it in the first place. And that's largely been given up on. And to some ways, I find it confounding. I understand the sinister reasons why a local government might spend COVID money on police, as Biden suggested they do. But in a self-interested way, I don't understand why, these air purifiers are not being put in every room just to keep fewer people from getting sick and to keep workers from getting sick. Except to understand it through the lens of when CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said masks are the scarlet letter of this pandemic. No one wants to think about it. And it's almost like there's this collective will to not even address anything that could be done to reduce transmission because it's a reminder of this thing that so many want to forget about and just act like isn't happening.
Lastly, and I had so many other questions, but unfortunately, we probably have to wrap after this. I wanted to touch on one of your chapters, Chapter 7, Cages, which talked about how the carceral state has essentially exacerbated the viral underclass conditions in the way that it deals with houselessness in particular. Can you just talk a little bit about that chapter for our audience?
Carcerality is one of the major drivers of pandemics, and I've seen that with HIV and AIDS for many years, even though HIV is what I would call a very inefficient virus. It actually it's very hard for it to move between people. It needs many opportunities to take hold in another person, and the prison still plays a big role in how it moves. And then you have something like COVID, which is an extremely efficient virus that easily moves between people very casually. And sometimes you can see the math work out almost in a one-to-one way. The U.S. has 4% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners, people who are incarcerated. And we've also, we still have 4% of the population. We have 35% of the world's monkeypox cases. And we have pretty consistently had between 20 and 25% of COVID cases and COVID deaths. Last week when I was looking, it was almost exactly, the U.S. had about 25% of the world's COVID deaths. And there is a direct relationship here, and you can think of it in various ways. Part of it is just where we spend our money. Biden is, again, asking for 100,000 new cops, as Bill Clinton did, and that's money that could go to other places. The amount of police resources that went to the city of Minneapolis towards cops are a reason why. I think George Floyd lost his job from COVID and did not end up, with safe housing and food and things he needed, but ended up in a lethal encounter with a police officer. Some of that just has to do with where the money is going. Some of it goes to direct transmission itself. COVID is very much just being moved in prisons and jails. And I would say actually local jails are a bigger engine here than even prisons, because the U.S. moves hundreds of thousands of people every week into jails, and they're there for a few days, and then if they can bond out, they go home. And then more come in and more go home. And so it's this direct engine of literally just moving the virus between human beings in these cages and then sending them back into their communities back and forth. But then prisons and jails also create what I call these secondary engines. Once you're incarcerated, you're much more likely to become homeless. it becomes extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get long-term employment, good employment, the kind of employment that has, you know, good health insurance. That almost entirely leaves once people are marked by incarceration. And so the U.S. carceral system is physically moving the virus in a short-term way, but also subjecting people to long-term consequences that are going to leave their bodies more open to pathogens for the rest of their lives.
Well, Stephen Thrasher, I couldn't recommend his book more highly enough, The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. Thanks so much for your time today, Stephen. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Emma. Take care.
Take care. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to be joined by Dominique Remy, writer, director, and producer of the project Canary. And we'll be talking about that a little bit in a second. We are back, and we are joined now by Dominique Remy, writer, director, and producer of the Project Canary, which is a documentary about maternal mortality rates in the U.S. Dominique, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So tell us a little bit about this project here, because it could not be more relevant than ever in the midst of our national conversation about women's rights to their own bodies and that relationship to healthcare in this country.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know if you saw or some of the listeners saw, but I think a couple of days ago, the CDC came out with a report saying that 80% of maternal mortalities were preventable, which when I actually started this project, the figure was, I want to say 60 to 64% preventable, which was also unacceptable to me when I decided to start this project. So to see that figure spike up so drastically, it was just like, yeah, there, like you said, there's no better time to have this conversation. And it's not just really a conversation about statistics. What I've found throughout my research and just, you know, seeing other content that's similar is that there's not a lot of discussion about, one, the internal lives of people who have lost their loved ones to this, or, you know, the children who have lost parents, and just an overall discussion about what leads to this. A lot of the times you'll hear about, I think the biggest one is about medical bias and needing to have more racial equity training, which I will never discount as something that's not needed, but it's not sufficient. With our project and my whole ethos, I'm looking for something that is more comprehensive. So, and that's also why we titled it Canary, because I think this crisis and birthing people of color, particularly Black and Indigenous women, are, you know, at a much higher risk than their white counterparts, serve as the canary in the coal mine for something that's just much more deeper and institutionalized than just, we need to have doctors be more sensitive to people of color.
Or we need the people of color to be more educated about their options, right? Because, like, what's so intersectional about your topic here is it's also just, it's universal childcare is involved, universal healthcare is involved, housing is involved, structural racism is involved as well. And so this, it is a bit of a confluence of all of those factors, and it manifests itself in just these staggering maternal mortality rates for Indigenous, Black, essentially non-white women in this country.
Absolutely. And that's like why I decided to take a more reproductive justice lens, because exactly what we're listing out, that is, you know, when reproductive justice was being established in the 90s by Monica, I'm blanking on her name right now, because there's multiple people. I think there was like 11 people who were part of it, including Dr. Angela Davis. But when it was first established in 1994, it was a call to action when the Clinton administration did not want to, you know, go through with universal healthcare at the time. And it was, you know, Black and Latinx women of color who were like, listen, part of reproductive health and rights is all of these things. It's economic justice. It's housing justice. You know, it is the right to not be a parent. It is the right to be a parent and to be a parent with dignity in an environment that you can be a parent in. And that includes childcare, education, housing. And to speak to housing, I know in addition to the staggering statistic, we also see that children in Chicago were exposed to lead all of 2021. That is also part of the reproductive justice plight, and why we want to have these conversations. That's not just about, Black people are dying at higher rates. Maybe it's something having to do specifically with Black people. And it's like, no, it has something to do with the structural things in place that further affect people of color. And I want to also mention that there's like things like social determinants of health, which is really big in terms of like how your environment is and how your environment has been structured can lead a lot to health problems. So it's not exactly what you said. It's not just, you know, one aspect, but it's a confluence of all these things. And I think that is the conversation we should be having, because it doesn't make sense to me that, you know, there's just been like story after story. I know when Beyonce came out and Serena Williams came out in 2017 about their health complications, that was a big news cycle for, oh, let's talk about Black women and pregnancy, and then it faded out, and then there's something else in the news, and then it fades out. And it's like there's exploratory committees after committees after committees. The White House had, I want to say in 2020, recognized Maternal Health Week in April. But what does that do for the 80% of people who die from preventable deaths? And that's the kicker for me. It's preventable.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's part of what you're, well, we it really fits in nicely with the conversation that we just had with Stephen Thrasher, because a lot of this just involves one, like having very literal healthcare literacy in this country because of our for-profit system, very few resources, and then, you know, race essentialist views about about non-white bodies. So just tell us a bit about the film project and what you're trying to get off the ground here as well, and how our viewers can help in like this comprehensive look into the conditions and the problems that you describe.
Yeah, so it's been a long journey of pretty much building relationships with people on the ground. So not just birth workers or reproductive justice advocates, but people who have been affected. So it's maternal mortalities and morbidities. Morbidities meaning someone who was close to having a lethal event but made it out. So there's a lot of threads that we want to thread together. And part of it is we want to really shed a light on the folks that, like, I know I'm following them on different platforms, but I'm just like, why isn't it making more news? Like, why aren't their stories, you know, making more of a noise? So I want to do that for them, but also I don't want it to be something that's scaremongering, because I am a Black woman of childbearing age and I do intend to be a parent myself. And looking at these statistics and seeing, you know, who I am, I'm like, oh my God, does it make sense to even have a child here in the United States? And the answer is yes, because we're going to make that. So part of the film will also be about engaging people, talking about a lot of like the policy aspects that so many researchers, so many birth workers have been talking about. So it's not just, you know, talking about the statistics and learning about the lives of people who've been affected, but also speaking with doulas and midwives who talk about having a new model of care that is more holistic, that has you have a birth team. You're not just seeing the doctor. You have someone who's with you to advocate for you, by way of having a birth worker who's a midwife or doula, by, you know, implementing and lobbying essentially for, I want to say universal parental leave at a federal level, not something that is just, you know, sanctioned by your job, private job. A lot of low income women will not be able to take off. And if they do, it comes out of their paycheck because they're hourly workers. So something like that will determine whether or not you're even giving your body enough rest. Because the mortality window, a lot of people don't realize, is not just within the moments of labor, but an entire year and postpartum. And then to talk about postpartum depression is in the article that I saw accounted for nearly a quarter of the mortalities. And to go back to the systems that we don't have in place, we do not have a mental health system in place that really does, I want to say like cradle postpartum. I think postpartum actually just really became something that people talked about more openly along with miscarriages like 15 years ago. So we have a really long way to go. And part of the film is to put these things out there, talk about the studies, talk about the people who are on the floor, like who are on the ground, who are not just, you know, activists, but they're doing these and putting this in practice. There's multiple places that they're putting these things in practice. And try to like engage folks to lobby on multiple levels. Like if you can't write to your senator, you know, definitely know someone who's a parent who's probably about to give birth. Like there's so much that we can do interpersonally as a society to make society more welcoming for people in really vulnerable positions.
Yeah. So, I mean, all of this just really, it sounds incredible and also ambitious, which is why our audience needs to help you out. How can anybody who's watching help out with Canary?
Absolutely. So we have our website, thecanaryfilmproject.com, which you can find out more about our project. And we have like social media assets where you can share a lot of like the statistics that I've been talking about here on your social media. We have like social media tiles for both Twitter and Instagram. And on Twitter, we are @canary_film, and then it's the same on Instagram. Share first of all, but also we do have a film fund to help, like you said, bring this off the ground. It is an ambitious project. We are currently shooting in Queens and the Bronx. The Bronx has the highest rates in all of the five boroughs. And what we would like to do with the funding that we accrue is to make sure that we're giving our participants the like necessary attention that's needed when we have these resources. So that is the next step, is to really focus in on our subjects, both in Queens and in the Bronx, to, you know, bring forth this story. And we will further expand into the United States. But we're really starting homegrown, and with your support, your financial support, it would definitely be able to launch much more quicker.
All right. So, guys, help Dominique out if you can. It's thecanaryfilmproject.com. We'll be putting links in the descriptions and both the YouTube description, podcasts, et cetera, for people to check it out, and also on majority.fm. Thanks so much, Dominique. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Looking forward to seeing how this progresses, for sure.
Absolutely. Me too.
Yeah. All right. Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye. All right. With that said, we are going to wrap up the free part of this show, and we are going to head into the fun half. 646-257-3920. Matt, what is happening over on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, as we let Brandon and Binder in, on Left Reckoning, GP Jacob last Tuesday night to talk about rent control in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and how even people say, liberal Democrats in urban areas are threats to democracy, just as Republicans are. St. Paul and Minneapolis both voted for strong rent control, particularly St. Paul. And when it got to the city council and mayoral desks, they decided, oh, we need to look into this with our partners in the real estate industry and figure out how we can do the right exceptions that make sure our capitalist friends aren't hurt by this. So it's really frustrating. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
And for me, I will plug myself while we're setting up Binder and Brandon. Check out ESVN, the episode on Monday where we talked a bit about one, the WNBA championship, and two, also the recap of the second week of NFL games. But today at 4 p.m., we're doing ESVN OT, coined by Zeke Gonzalez. Thank you very much. Where Bradley and I will be trying to rebound from a poor performance last week from both of us on our NFL picks. Week three, we're going to be picking some games and also probably talking a bit more about the developments in the Brett Favre case, as well as Robert Sarver being forced to sell the Phoenix Suns and the Mercury.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of, we talked a little bit in the Griner topic up top of the show, but this is players flexing their muscle a little bit and throwing an owner out, which is, you love to see it, because it looked like when this report was released that it was going to be an attempt to maybe say, look, we,
it's like the Warren penalty.
It's like the Warren Commission, right? Like we studied it and, you know, we didn't, you know, do better next time. And they decided to ban him from basketball operations for a year, but meaning he could come back and be in charge of all the employees that he was abusing for that entire time. So LeBron.
Yep.
And I believe Chris Paul, who's on the Suns, spoke out and said this is not acceptable. And you know what? That's a very lesson that we don't need fucking owners, right? And they are absolutely superfluous. And the idea that they should be able to get around saying the N-word and being appropriate to women in their job, a job that everyone there like grew up wanting to do because they love basketball, and like just becomes some rich asshole owns a team, he gets to abuse them. It's not acceptable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll, many of my thoughts echoed there, and we'll be talking about that.
I clearly have my own thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I'll stick around.
And just because if we got a few questions about this, I think on Twitter or other social media, we now have a, thanks to Dorsey, we have an ESPN playlist on the Majority Report YouTube channel now, so where you can find all of the episodes. And for clips, youtube.com/ESPN show.
Thank you, Bradley. Good job with that. And 5 stars on all the podcast platforms, please. What's up, guys?
Hey guys?
How are you? And what is happening over on the Discourse and Doomed and Scam Economy, because everyone here is so busy all the time?
Absolutely. Matt, why don't you go first?
Sure.
Who's the alpha?
So I guess I am in this scenario. Well, hello, everybody. I was just listening to Emma talk about what's been happening in the world of sports, which reminds me, and I've seen a few calls online for it. Got to do a pro wrestling segment with me, right? I mean,
yeah, Bender, come on today. Let's recap Grand Slam.
We'll do it. My level of knowledge on pro wrestling is really bad, so you would have to kind of, the whole segment would be you and Bradley educating me.
All right, yeah, but I think people would enjoy that.
You can call it talking to a girl about wrestling.
I'd be willing to talk about wrestling.
Conversation. Sorry.
I'd be willing to talk about wrestling, but only if we talked about things that happened like between like 1997 and like 2005.
The Attitude Era.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
that was when I was watching wrestling.
that was the good years of for storylines, at least. Yeah. But anyway, on Doomed on Tuesday, which you can check out at youtube.com/MattBinder and at doomedcast.com, I spoke with Twitter user Ogle of the Wasting Times, at the Wasting Times, who's done a wonderful job of tracking a specific person over the past couple of months by the name of Jackson Hinkle. And the reason I did an episode on him now instead of any other time is because he has been making the rounds on right-wing media, most recently One America News. Obviously, that's the news network that all leftists find themselves on, promoting his new, I guess you could call it a grift, MAGA communism. Mm. And we break down exactly what Jackson Hinkle is promoting it as and how it makes absolutely zero sense. So check that out, doomedcast.com and youtube.com/MattBinder. Yeah. And on Scam Economy this week, no show tonight. The show will be tomorrow instead, same time, 9 p.m. Eastern time, live. I'll be taking calls and everything, the usual. And my guest is Salvadoran InfoSec specialist Domingo Flores, who joins me to talk about what's been happening in El Salvador a year now, the one-year anniversary of the country and its right-wing authoritarian president, Bukele, passing this Bitcoin law that basically sort of imposed on all the people in El Salvador that they had to transact with Bitcoin if they were, you know, selling goods or services to people. So that's at scameconomy.com and also at youtube.com/MattBinder. And that episode will be up tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern time.
Awesome. All right. Now the discourse.
definitely check out the discourse on all of your podcast platforms, Spotify, iTunes, Patreon. We should have a new episode out for you. I know I say that every week this weekend. That's why it's always relevant if it happens. Although we should have some few ideas for a few interviews of prominent figures out there I want to, you know, put out. So, you know, you should look forward to that as well. Bringing back the interviews, getting more people implicated in my inevitable canceling.
All right.
What are you going to be canceled for, Brandon?
I think I'm going to inevitably be canceled for, like, once I move and have a nice new, like, streaming space, like having a Twitch stream that's entirely about recapping multiple seasons of shows from the 90s and early 2000s that only I remembered, like, very, very, in a very detailed way, but often getting a lot of things wrong.
Right. So you're being canceled for being too, like, stuck in
for
a
the
cultural...
truth. Capital T.
Canceled for truth. Yeah, just like
capital T. Well, actually, I'll probably get canceled for, like, what happened on Twitter with my first suspension, where, like, I'm making fun of a conspiracy theory and the algorithm can't tell that I'm, like, joking about it.
No sarcasm bug in the algorithm. All right. Well, we look forward to your inevitable cancellation, and there'll be a lot of good content for the show. 646-257-3920. We will see you in the fun half. Bye-bye. It might take us
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is it me?
Is it me?
It is you.
If it's me, hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go for a walk.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though. Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge map.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-35-501. 1/2. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$3 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.